Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 14 of the Renowned Podcast. We're your co-hosts, Allison Hager
and Mark Schultz.
Renowned is a podcast for the curious. We dust off the commonplace to look for new relevance as we challenge ourselves to think critically about the objects that surround us. How do they echo humanity's past, reflect the present, or foreshadow the future? With that, Mark, do you want to remind everyone what this week's noun is?
Absolutely. The noun is difference. Difference.
Oh, you didn't spell it this time.
Like right. I was thinking about it. I was like, that's a longer one to spell, but I could. Well, maybe just because. Everyone. D-I-F-F-E-R-E-N-C-E. That's a little foreshadowing of how deep I'm going to go down my etymology rabbit hole here in a little bit.
Oh my goodness.
It's a particularly deep one today.
Get excited.
Woo! So, nerd out.
Shall we roll our shiny dice?
Yes. You just said dice. It's dice because you were talking about both of them.
I was. See? That's why. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I have a two.
I have a two. Roll again.
I have a two again.
I dropped my die.
If you have a two, it's becoming, again, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern.
I have a five.
Okay. Hey, you won. It's been me for a while.
This is the first of 2023 that I will go first.
Excellent. All right.
So for any of you who are just absolutely foaming at the mouth to hear Mark talk about etymology for God knows how long.
I mean, you all are. I realize.
Sorry. You're going to have to listen to me first.
The number of DMs I get begging for etymology is
That's
zero.
What happens.
All right. Let me put some time, 15 seconds on the clock for your Just the Hits. Are you ready?
You ready? I'm ready.
You look ready. All right. And hit it.
Humanity has more in common than the differences that separate us.
Well done. Yeah. Plenty of time left. Pithy. Yes. Pithy. I passed the pith stick your way this week. I don't know what that means. It's a weird sentence. It's a weird visual. All right. My turn, I suppose.
Your turn. Are you ready?
Yeah. I'm going to have to speed through this, I feel.
Okay. That was like me last week, I think. Okay. Ready and go.
The concept of difference is huge, and while it can be arguably the basis for all human understanding, exploring how we see difference leads to a fascinating exploration of the physical and the technical.
2 seconds left.
Boom.
Well done. Wow. I feel like this is going to be a particularly deep rabbit hole on your side.
Please.
Okay.
All right. But it's all you.
Stage all right. Well, then we better. We better get to it so we leave the space for Mark's deep dive. Okay.
I don't think it's going to be particularly long, but anyway, we'll see.
Okay.
Strap in, audience. I'm just kidding. We'll be at normal time.
Stop scaring people.
I know, right?
Okay. So we're actually recording this episode on the last day of February, which is Black History Month here in the United States. And I think my take on this episode's noun will fit neatly into honoring not only Black Americans, but people around the world of all quote unquote races. And my quote unquote around races isn't just a throwaway phrase here. Racism is defined as the systemic oppression of a racial group to the social, economic, and political advantage of another, and also a belief that race is a fundamental determinant of human traits and capacities, and that racial differences produce an inherent superiority of a particular race. And of course, the behaviors and attitudes that reflect and foster that belief that I just mentioned. So racism is prejudice based on difference, most often differences in skin color or ethnicity. And racism has existed for at least thousands of years. Fear of the other in prehistoric times was a safety mechanism for survival. So anything unknown or different was first approached as a threat. And as we've discussed in other episodes, I think we've touched on many seemingly hardwired survival instincts from our prehistoric days as a species don't always serve us so well in the modern era. And this is one of them, I think. Racism in the U.S. is, I'm sad and angry and frustrated, to say very much alive and well. And it seems to be thriving in other parts of the world. And it appears to many that there's even been an increase in racism in the US over the past 7 or so years. But I'd argue that the number of racists in our country hasn't actually changed that much. They've been here all along, and have just felt more empowered to wave their ignorant flag of hate since Trump hit the world stage of politics, sort of empowered that.
I'm hoping in some ways it's gone down. However, their platforms have amplified their voice, perhaps, but that's just a thought.
Something I hope that's the case. It's a really interesting point that they have been, their voices have been amplified, but you're right. Maybe
hopefully
we're just hearing more of a smaller number. But we've all seen over the past, you know, decade and before, but again, I feel like this is on the rise. To think about it a little differently, though, like you just did, Mark, maybe it's because we have more video technology now. So we're seeing more. So we've seen countless videos over the past few years of egregious police violence against Black Americans. Too many uploaded videos of random white people spewing racist hatred at strangers, sometimes violently, and way too many microaggressions against people of color that go unchecked every day. So I wanted to talk about this really difficult subject. The idea held by too many people that humans with Black skin are fundamentally different than humans with white skin, who are different than humans with yellow skin, who are different than humans with brown skin. If you read any statements, credos from white supremacist groups, you'll see that their belief in the superiority of whites is most often attributed to science. So the notion that whites are biologically superior to other races. So let me dive into the word race a little bit, since I started with a whole quote unquote, but then kept using it. So
before you jump in, Allison, and sorry to interrupt again, it made me think of eugenics and like the science in the 1920s that was used largely for the basis of Nazism and like the extermination and the cleansing of races. I don't know if that's where you're going to go, but that makes me think of that outdated, very I always defend science, and I feel like the science at its core is neither good nor bad, but how it can be distorted or used is such a horrifying thing. Sorry, again, to interrupt, but you laid that out so well that it jumped right to mind. Like, woof.
Love that you interrupted. Never apologize. I always like it. I always think it works better as a conversation anyway. And I won't be deep diving on eugenics, but I will be talking about it. And you're right. It kind of fits right in here, and it actually kind of leads to one of my big questions as well. So, so that was perfect.
It's like humanity is not a bunch of pea plants to be, you know what I mean? Manipulated in that sense where
and even if they were
makes me sick.
Even if they were, it doesn't hold here. Well, okay, I'll come to that shortly. So race is commonly used to define a particular set of people. It most often based on skin tone. It is not based on biology, and I'm going to go into more detail on this, as white supremacists would have you believe. But race is rather an idea that, but regardless of that, too many people still ascribe racial differences to biology. It does not exist. Just saying it again for the folks in the cheap seats. It does not exist in a biological sense. What we perceive as biological differences are, if differences at all, they're cultural and they're socioeconomic. So scientists have been saying this for decades. In the post-eugenics age, scientists have been saying this for decades. I was an anthropology major in college in the 90s, and I even learned that then. So this isn't new. And the bottom line is that skin color variations are just that. They're skin deep. There's nothing more to it. But since there are so many racists still in the world, I thought I'd go into more detail on this to arm us all with the actual knowledge to deconstruct their arguments, should we ever find ourselves faced with such a conversation or the opportunity to educate someone. So people will argue, so one argument you'll hear is, well, skin color is based on genes, right? The color of our skin, we have genes that express in the color of our skin. So wouldn't it be logical then to say that humans with different skin color, which is determined by genetics, would also have other genetic differences. Well, no, and I'm going to tell you why. So it turns out most of human genetic variation is what is called non-concordant. And what that means is that genes aren't correlated to each other. So for instance, skin color or eye color or hair texture is not correlated with, say, a person's height or their weight, things that are also not completely, but partially determined by genetics. And they're certainly not correlated with anything more complex like intelligence or athletic ability. Those things evolve and develop in entirely different ways. So here's just one example to kind of make this clearer. If we look at a global map of skin color, you will see, unsurprisingly to anybody, more humans with lighter skin living near the poles and more humans with darker skin living near the equator. Is this also then, is it that the people with the darker skin also have the same blood type? No. So it's theoretically based on the idea that as humans migrated out of Africa, those who settled closer to the poles dealt with significantly less sunlight in wintertime. And humans need sunlight for vitamin D, especially children, especially for children to develop healthily. And light skin absorbs more sunlight. Thus, a mutation for lighter skin was positively selected for in regions closer to the poles. Has nothing to do with anything else. It's not connected to any other gene. So there was a scientist named Richard Lewontin. He was an evolutionary biologist, a mathematician, and a geneticist. So he had a lot going on. And he wrote an article in 1972 titled "The Apportionment of Human Variation." And he was trying to determine how much genetic variation showed up in populations. And the conventional hypothesis was that you would find vast variation between races, right? So between Black people, white people, Asian people, and vast similarities within. And the amazing result of this study, again, 1972, like 50 years ago, but no, people still like to live under, you know, the myths they've created in their head, that on average, any given group you look at that you've defined as an ethnic group or a racial group has about 85% variation within it. So it's vastly more different than it is alike. So way more difference, right, than similarities. If you look at the similarity then, like the 15%, and you kind of, they break it down, then I'll link the study. There's a lot here, so I'm not going to go into all the details because I just want to kind of give the example so folks understood non-concordance. But only about like 6 to 7% of that 15% variation occurs between races. So like basically race explains very little of human variation, just incredibly little. So it turns out geography is perhaps a better way to explain the variation. So his work really showed that the basic like human plan, the genomic plan, is just that. It's just a really basic plan that we all have, and is found almost anywhere in the world. So why isn't that the commonly held belief? We have science that tells us this is true. Because, you know, we myopically happen to ascribe greater significance to skin color because it's a physical cue. But our genes are mobile. Humans have always been mobile, and that's what accounts for the variation. So let me turn the lens a little bit and look at something that's considered a racial divide in the U.S. The disparity in healthcare received by Black Americans is massive. From the availability of care through the quality of care, Black women are believed significantly less often than white women when they state they're in pain, for instance. Black Americans are also more likely to suffer from certain diseases, diabetes, for instance. Is this because of their skin color? No, it is because of socioeconomic conditions that have persisted since slavery through Jim Crow and up until today. Meaning large numbers of Black Americans are financially disadvantaged due to the impacts of our social and our political history. This means decreased access to healthy, affordable food. It means they also have decreased access, or they can't afford preventative medical care. So you're not getting medical care until you're already in a dire straits. And on top of that, you have widespread distrust of the medical system and communities of color. And that distrust of the medical system is for incredibly good reason. So if you haven't heard of it, look up the Tuskegee syphilis trials from 1932. So Mark's just nodding his head because he already knows how horrible this is. Yeah. And again, there's so much here we could talk about, but I'll just, for folks who don't know about it, I'll give you the broad strokes. So the study started in 1932 and it continued until 1972. And 600 impoverished Black sharecroppers in and around Tuskegee, Alabama, were enlisted in a study in return for free medical care. So they were just told it was, you know, a medical study. They weren't really told new details, but they were told they could have free medical care, which was a huge, you know, a huge thing. So of these 600, they tested them, found out 399 of them had syphilis, and 201 did not. And the point of this study was to look at the impact on humans of untreated syphilis. So 1932, we start, 1972, we end. By 1947, syphilis was treatable with penicillin, and penicillin was widely available. And these men, who, by the way, were never told they had syphilis, they were tested and then they were divided into the group and then the control group of the 201 who did not, never told they had the disease. They were not treated specifically so that the medical establishment could study the long-term impacts of syphilis infection. And by 1972, and the study only ended in 1972 because of a leak to the press. They didn't, no one went, you know what, maybe this is just absolutely immoral and evil. By that like time,
the most unethical clinical trial procedure. I mean, unfortunately,
in history,
probably not in history, sadly, because it leaked and we saw it. Like, you can only imagine if that was happening there, what had happened in the past. But
yeah, no, that's a very good point. So by the time the study ended, 28 of the patients had died directly from syphilis. 100 more had died from complications related to syphilis. 40 of the patients' wives were infected with syphilis because they didn't know they had it. And 19 children were born with congenital syphilis. So the impacts here were huge and unimaginable. Another horror to look up, one of many, look up J. Marion Sims. He's known as the father of gynecology. And he operated on Black women without anesthesia because it was, quote, not worth the trouble. And he did this because he was trying to advance the understanding and treatment of fistulas. If you don't know what a fistula is, it's a horrible thing when abscesses open up between the vaginal and the anal walls, causing, you know, leakage and constant infections, just absolutely horrible things. So he just used Black women as guinea pigs. But we call him the father of gynecology because, you know, he just, you know, learned so much. So these are only two examples of many, and I'll leave it there, but just to make the point of one of the reasons that the racial disparity does exist, that people of color receive much lower quality healthcare due to these complicated socioeconomic and historical factors, which lead to distrust. They're not predisposed to more diseases like diabetes and obesity. You will see statistically show up in higher rates in the Black community in the US. It's not because biologically they are more prone to get this. And now I'm going to give you the next step that you would get when you were possibly having a conversation with somebody about this who disagrees with you. So some people are thinking, okay. I understand all these historical things, but we do know that certain diseases are genetically determined. You know, we do know that certain diseases can be passed on in families. So they sure are, but again, they're not genetically concordant with skin color. So for instance, proponents of the races being different will cite the example of sickle cell anemia. You hear this very commonly, right? It's thought of as a Black disease, like quote unquote, in the medical community, we'll call it a Black disease. Sickle cell anemia arose from a mutation that helps individuals fight off malaria. So the shape of the red blood cells changes into what looks more like a sickle form instead of a round form. And they do not get the devastating effects of malaria. So sickle cell came to be as a mutation in parts of the world that were hit heavily by malaria. This would be West Africa. Once deforestation started there, this would be India. This would be parts of the Middle East. So people with Black skin in East Africa or South Africa, for instance, they don't have this mutation. It's not a Black thing. It's people who descended from areas that had higher malaria. So sorry, I've just lost my place because I'm getting all worked up.
No, I love it because it's so many things. So you mentioned like this conversation you might be having with somebody who disagrees. In so many ways, if they were to use these, it would be hard for me to maintain a conversation with them because I feel like they're distorting things so much that
exactly
it's almost illogical. It's so illogical that
it's easy to get turned around. Like, so someone says, wait a minute, you're telling me that some diseases don't have genetic components. Well, no, some diseases do for sure. Right. But
right.
Not in the way you're talking about, like not linked to skin color, linked to geography.
Right.
So it's if you're geography, a family.
In that way, I know I said we're all not a bunch of pea pods, but in a way we are also those because we are adapting. That is, these folks don't believe in evolution either.
That's a very good point. That's a good point. So I mean,
if you're not believing in that, you're not going to understand how, things would morph.
How this
because if I understood you, Allison, the sickle cell anemia is a negative that came about from something that mutated in order to be more protective against something else.
That's right? Exactly right. So people with sickle cell anemia are not going to die when they get malaria. I mean, they might get slightly sick, but they're not going to get very sick because the malaria can't do whatever it needs to do to our cells.
So there's something to tell that person. It's like you're focusing on something that came about from like what could be considered in say a town that was being devastated by malaria as like a superhuman evolution trait, something amazing. But then there's this.
Yeah.
So down.
Yeah. There are very negative consequences to sickle cell anemia. The red blood cells can't carry as much oxygen. Right. So to your point, it was a positive mutation for the geography it was in. And now if you fast forward, like I said before, humans are mobile. We've always been mobile.
Right.
So now you have someone who's descended from people who were from, let's say,
and it's
India.
Not linked to a social intent. It's not like they all got together to decide to do something that then changed. Oh, yeah. It drives me nuts.
Yep. Exactly. So, I mean, I just wanted to give those examples so people start to see like the layers you can peel back here and the arguments that you'll hear and kind of some examples you could have to fight back basically. So as Carl Sagan once said, I have to work Carl Sagan quote him because I seem to always work a Carl Sagan quote in. So of course I went hunting for this, but he once said, quote, some racists still reject the plain testimony written in the DNA that all the races are not only human, but nearly indistinguishable. So sure enough, and again, I'm going to repeat it again, there are no genetic markers that define race. In fact, the genetic variation, so I talked about the Lewontin study, where you could look at, you know, a group of like ethnically similar I keep using finger quotes for those of you not watching, similar, you will see 85% variation, not similarity. The genetic variation in humans is tiny. In fact, of all the known species on Earth, we are among the top most genetically homogenous species in the world. And like to give you an example, so anyone who has seen those adorable documentaries on the penguins, down in Antarctica, you know, and they're waddling along and you get Morgan Freeman narrating, they look exactly the same, right? They're two times more genetically diverse than we are as a species. Fruit flies, which basically all look alike to us, they have 10 times the genetic variation that humans do. It's just incredible how much we are all the same. Not just like, we're basically the same with like, we are.
They're dying so fast that it would be devastating to their species if they weren't diverse, probably. I'm assuming
probably.
That it's a bit in like a lower risk and higher diversification, but
assuming. So scientists, Mark brought up eugenics earlier. So there's just been a horrifying history over hundreds of years of what they called themselves race scientists, right? Looking to find these differences linked to what they define as a biological race. For example, a relatively recent one in our human history. So they've all failed, by the way, like they've all been debunked. So for instance, more recently in human history, Jesse Owens, famous track star in the 1930s, winning gold for the US in Hitler's Germany, no less. He was a black man from Cleveland, Ohio. My grandfather went to high school with him. He was picked apart when he came home. No one could understand how a black man could have done so well. Weren't black men supposed to be, you know, genetically inferior to whites? And he beat every white man on the field. The majority were white men. So he was picked apart by doctors and scientists looking for a physical difference. There must be some racial difference here that actually would make Black men and women more athletically able. We've all heard this. You hear this today, right? This is a stereotype that, you know, sticks around
NBA
today.
And everything. Yeah,
exactly. So, you know, spoiler, no difference. Like they proposed maybe he had an extra bone in his leg. They proposed like Black men specifically have extra muscle in their leg genetically, all sorts of stuff. There's nothing there. And then think about this as well when we're trying to
I hate to jump in, because that was one that I actually, I'm going to be fully transparent, was something that I thought was still true. So I'm glad that you found that it's not. Because in my mind, it's again what you do with that information. Even if that was true, who cares? It's in the same level of adaptation potentially as the geographical or other types of things from whites having lighter skin color as they move north. There might have been something in human history that would have meant that a certain terrain or and who knows? But like, right. I guess my point is like, again, even if that were to be true, so what? Anyway.
No, I think that's a really valid point. And so I'll give you another example.
These are physical things. They're not, to your point, they're not mental capacity. They're not, it just drives me crazy.
And there is something interesting. Obviously, there's always more to learn with science and there are things we don't know. So if you look at a lot of the past winners, like long distance runners, look at like the New York Marathon, you'll see a lot of them are East African. So people will argue, well, like East Africans, Kenyans specifically, but East Africans tend to really excel at this. You know, is there a reason? Can we link it genetically? Scientists actually still don't know why that is. So to your point, there may be a reason that like geographically coming from East Africa, it is it a genetic marker? Who knows? Or is it something more
like the
training?
But then it becomes a social thing though, right? Now it is known. So then you have people who are going to find some country pride in that and then dedicate themselves to running more. I mean, it could.
Yeah. Right. So it the whole thing is just a really big, ugly ball of wax.
Yeah, yeah. I meant to say before, the more you described the DNA part of it, I wanted to jump in and mention the more that I feel like we find that we are all the same in our immense amount of difference. I know that sounds bizarre. We're all the same in an immense amount of variation that's possible in our DNA. Mm-hmm. And when you get to that level of difference, it's almost like a sheet of paper that's like a nondescript color. It's like everything, it's like light. Now, granted, some crazy racist will be like, light's white, blah, 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 whatever. But I'm saying like in pigment,
and
it's black.
We're then going to have to explain to them what
like what
prism
I mean.
Is.
Right,
but also
exactly.
Then what a prism is and how light is not
and that
light.
You can flip it. The combination of all things in pigment is black. The combination of all things in light is white. So I don't want to go down that crazy wormhole, but or open that.
Well, actually, that's like a really philosophical way to think about it, which I actually kind of like.
Sorry.
My next point was like is way less erudite, which is just another reminder. Like, so okay, we're saying Jesse Owens, right? Black man, incredible athlete. He will always be thought of not just as an athlete, as a black athlete. But think about this. So to use an example, Colin Powell, right? Colin Powell considered to be a black American. He's just as much Irish as he is black. Ray Campanella, who I can't believe I'm making a sports reference here, but it just fit too well. He was a famous Dodger and he was considered to be a black player. He actually started out in what was once called the Negro Leagues. He's just as much Italian as he is black. Skin color doesn't mean anything biologically, but that we look at these people as black and then everything that comes on top of it, right? All the racism that's then attached to that, instead of looking at them as Irish or Italian or anything else. So coming back around to what Mark said right when I first started. So atrocities beyond measure have occurred based on the belief that people of color or non-majority ethnicities are inferior. Eugenics was popularized, as Mark said, and eventually became a foundation for Adolf Hitler's final solution, resulting in the death of 6 million Jews and millions of others on top of the 6 million Jews, including Soviet citizens, homosexuals, the Romani, and many others, like including many people of color. And eugenics and kind of the race science really started as a way to dehumanize people of color. All the way back before it was called eugenics, how could we justify slavery if blacks are the same as whites? How could we justify stealing the Native Americans' land if we didn't consider them savages and find the science to prove it?
I'm so glad you said that, because I felt like that those tragedies locked in exactly the guilt and how to face that became, right? All the research around to face something that has become part of your identity or part of your belief system is so threatening and literally perceived by the body as like a physical threat. Like, yeah, they just wouldn't own up to it, so to speak. So you just cling to these things. I'm so sorry, but that resonates with me so strongly. Everything you're saying about like, how would you deal with these horrific things that have happened in the past? If you were to have the strength of character to go back and be like, this was a massive, massive, horrifying mistake and we're not going to fix it. Instead, no, let's clamp down on justifying why.
Ugh. Yeah, absolutely. Sorry. It started far back. Well, it started further back than this, but Thomas Jefferson, in some of his lesser known writings, I forget what it's called. I'll link it, something about Virginia. He kind of was just theorizing that Blacks weren't as intelligent than us, that Native America, like all these things, because it was one of the authors who said all men are created equal, and he couldn't stand by that if he didn't find a way to debunk it. Well, only these sorts of men. And also certainly not women, right? So a lot of people were excluded there. So that led then more into race science, which led eventually to eugenics. The final example I was just going to make, because sometimes we think a lot about, as we should, the history of slavery and Jim Crow in this country, the history of what we did to the Native Americans. And also Chinese immigrants, especially during the Gold Rush years, were locked into menial tasks. You know, watch any old Western and you have a Chinese man doing the laundry and cleaning the houses and all that. Well, the powers that be didn't want them competing for the riches. So we had to characterize them as unsuitable for Western civilization. So that is how it's done, folks. Like, that is how we create walls so that other people can't get what we want. Not because they're biologically inferior, biologically different, biologically less intelligent. It's because we don't want them to have what we, in the majority, have. So it is all, you know, socio-political, economic. So there is so much on this topic. There are so many studies. So I've only given you the tiniest taste of each. I'll link a lot of things in this show if you want to learn more. But I do hope this has armed you with some data to refute the ignorance that kind of still abounds in this world about race. Before I wrap, I'll just tell you a funny personal story. So back in the 90s, my boyfriend at the time, for many years, he was kind of like a more conservative politically and just thought-wise than I was. And I was constantly hammering away at him. And one of the things I really was trying to educate him on at the time was that there's no biological basis for race. Race is a myth. It doesn't exist. And he came around. I think we were together for 8 or 9 years. And by the time it was over, he may have been more liberal than me. So yay.
Basis for our species differentiation from chimpanzees, I believe, or something like that.
Aren't we
like
97%?
Yep. Like, yeah.
At least it might be even higher. It might be 99.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I almost put that in here and then I'm like, I got to cut some stuff out. So basically he tells me a story, and this is after, you know, we were no longer together, but he tells me a story once we stayed in touch. He was in New York and something happened. Like, he was standing at a cross light and somebody else standing at the stoplight, like, got mad at him. I don't know why, for whatever reason. He didn't instigate a conflict, but maybe he was standing too close, you know, maybe whatever. And this other man ended up punching my ex-boyfriend in the face. So he files a police report and he's talking to the policewoman about it. And she happened to be a Black American. And I'm only mentioning that because the color of her skin, because it's relevant to the story. So she's taking all the details from, and they didn't get the guy. The guy was long gone, you know, the guy who assaulted him. And she's asking him all these questions so that they can try to identify him. And she asks what his race was. And he says, I don't believe in race. And she says, no wonder he hit you.
Oh, God.
which I just think is so funny. So like my advice here, I'm kind of saying, look, you have all this data to arm yourself and like to prove to people that race is not biologically a thing. But if a policeman or woman is asking for the race, what they really mean is the skin color and identification. And then it's okay, right, to use it because you know what they mean by the word, you know, they're not implying that there are genetic differences that right. go beyond.
I'm so glad you told that story because part of me wanted to jump in earlier. I've clearly interrupted you enough today, but to say the interesting sort of knife edge of this to a degree is because of the sociological historical treatment that has then defined a group of people by how others have treated them and their history, then to say things like, I don't see race. That's why that is such a hated, I think, thing nowadays, because while that can be celebrated from one perspective, that you are doing the research, that you care, that you're trying to be empathetic and inclusive, if you are then also saying that to say that there hasn't, you're, it could be misconstrued to say you're just wiping away all of the social treatment that has happened, and that yes, the person you're talking to who may look different than you is the output, is a weird word, is standing there from a long line of treatment that has had certainly an effect on their parents, their grandparents, their great grandparents. You know what I mean? To say you don't see that could be misconstrued as I don't acknowledge the yep. struggle or the impact.
No, you said that really well, because that's kind of exactly the point I wanted to make. We can say that that race, so, you know, the color of your skin is not like a biological determinant for any other, you know, behavior or characteristic. But we do know that because of all the socioeconomic history, racism is a thing. And so when we use race now, and that's why it's so hard for me to say like race doesn't exist, I'm going to keep using that word because it does exist culturally.
Right.
You just can't make the argument that, so you can argue very truthfully that people of color in the United States, at least many other places, are treated in ways that are different than white right. people.
Yeah.
And you can it's argue so that it is because of the color of their skin, but yeah. you can't argue that they are inferior because of the color of their skin.
Right.
So it, no, that's yeah. where this whole thing gets. Yeah.
Yeah. And it gets thorny. I mean, I take a second to just visually what I'm looking at right now, everyone, as we're recording, is, you know, Allison and I on camera talking about this, and we couldn't find two quote unquote more Caucasian looking. We are like, and so I realized that it's such a thorny weighted topic that I'm sure there'd be many folks just being like, how are you even justified to talk about this? Right. How are you even like to be a public, you know, you haven't lived it. You haven't struggled from it. So that is something I want to acknowledge, right? That, yeah, we are two white Americans talking about this, but I hope that that doesn't rob us of partaking in the discussion, I guess.
Yeah, no, and I'll add on to that because that's why I said in the beginning, it's a really difficult topic to discuss. I think it's a really important topic to discuss for everyone to discuss and to acknowledge what's going on in our country and around the world. And I heard an author, I am spacing on her name, but I will look it up and link it. She was being interviewed on a podcast and she had this quote. She was a Black woman and she was talking about exactly this, having conversations with white people about racism and how thorny it can get. And she had someone say to her once, I'm here. I'm not here to be right. I'm here to get it right. The idea being like, if I said anything today that you find offensive, as a person of color, let me know. Right. Cause I'm not the authority on this. I've had white privilege my entire life. And also we're all inherently racist in some ways, right? We all have unconscious bias that we're not even aware of. So if I said something wrong, I'd love to know. It's not the job of people of color to educate us, but if there's something you want to say, I would love to hear it. So I think that's a really good acknowledgement and call out, Mark. So I'm just going to end with a quote from, like I said, I'll link many things, but there was a great doc three-part series documentary on PBS back in 2003, actually, and I didn't watch it all. It's called Race, the Power of an Illusion. And they go into some of this detail as well, the parts that I saw and read about, but I will link that. But the quote I wanted to leave was John Lewis, just icon of the civil rights movement in the US, is quoted as saying, "Too many of us still believe our differences define us." And I think that is exactly right, because we are more alike than most people think. So that's it. So I, thanks for, I'm sorry that went longer than I thought. I tried to cut it down, but I hope that it was okay. But Mark, I think it's time to get into etymology.
Yeah, absolutely. I will jump on in here. So this one took me by surprise. I mean, I always love to start with researching the word. What does it mean? Where did it come from? Because I usually find my hook in that. Didn't entirely influence where I went with it, but I just found this really fascinating, got excited more than normal about this particular word. So when I went to the Oxford English Dictionary, there, you know, there are 11 definitions listed. As you could imagine, difference has a lot of things, many different uses in different areas. So it's such like a common, it's like a concept, right? That it can have a lot of permutations. So for example, the condition, quality, or fact of being different, a dissimilarity, or a particular way in which two or more things differ. So even in that, though, as you go through 11 different things that are listed there, I love that there is this idea of a condition or a quality, right? Like a difference, a dissimilarity, or B, the particular way in which two or more things differ, a point of dissimilarity. So you can almost say like a difference versus the difference. Does that make sense? Like we really split hairs with this word in many ways. There is a difference between two things, but also, oh, the fact that that person has red hair, that is the difference between them. That was an interesting nuance to me. Perhaps I'm alone in that geeking out, but I doubt it. You know, there's also the sense of it being a disagreement between people. You have a difference with someone. The term is used in math. The term is used in finance, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I think the key threading all of these definitions together is to look, again, shockingly enough, at where this word has evolved from and how it came to be. So you can really break it into, again, pieces, and you can look at DIF, coming from the prefix dis, D-I-S, which is something we've used in the history of our language to negate something or to mean like apart from something else. And then you can also look at the rest of the word, ferens, so dif and then ferens. Ferens itself can be broken into the root and then the end, so F-E-R. And then the rest of it, E-N-C-E. So just looking, you know, I think we can put the E-N-C-E to the side because that's something that is meant to take the root and make it a thing, to make it kind of a noun, for example. But fer, F-E-R, is the root. And it comes from like proto Indo-European, like way back. Anybody who might be a language geek as well knows that if you're going back in time, we usually say, oh, this English word came from the French, which came from the Latin. And if you go back beyond that, you're going into proto Indo-European roots. And so B-H-E-R, bear, I'm assuming, which you can see that comes kind of close to fair, and perhaps the way that it was pronounced, it was an easy switch to go from B-H-E-R, bear, into fair.
So Mark, I don't know if this is related, yep, but like a B-H in Gaelic is a V or an F sound.
Oh, amazing. So then it might very well be pronounced fair, in fact. Yeah. That's
like
amazing.
Maeve is M-A, sometimes E-B-H.
Oh, amazing.
So that V-F, you know, similarity.
Yeah. Cool. Oh, that makes a ton of sense. And so that root means to carry or to bear, and also to bear children is a use as well. If you go farther back in Sanskrit, there is a B-H-R that is meaning the same thing, sort of to carry. So that got exciting to me immediately because F-E-R it's huge. It's a superstar in language, right? Everything from fer, F-E-R, being iron in other languages. It's still in English as ferrous, something that is ferrous, is iron. And that this sense of a load or to bear a load, it also becomes the load itself, is in so many words. Confer, differ, refer, even words that are like splendiferous. You have the fur and so that means so many words. And also, if you look at the BHR, birth is naturally something. It is the carrying forth of the baby, the child, but also bring in names that I, this kind of blew my mind that I never thought of this. Maybe Allison, you have, or others may have been like, no duh, Mark, but the name Christopher, Christo and fur, it is like the Christ bearer. That is crazy to me. Lucifer, the light bearer. It just,
I love really, that. Yeah, no, I never put that together.
Right. So the more you look at any word that sort of has a fur or a P-H-E-R or something like that, or birth sometime, look at it. I'm not going to say that they're all going to be related, but they're probably all coming back to this sort of caring. So a carrying away from. So, right, our early sense of, again, making it something physical, like a bearing or a load, and that there's two piles almost. Oh my God, I'm saying piles again. Anyone who's watched previous episodes know I got in a pile rut. but again, it's we bring things to these basic forms. So for us, the concept of difference had to be in visualizing two things that were being carried apart, like masses that were pulled apart. All right, I'm done geeking out, but that's kind of where it came from. And I think that is, I don't know, it was super exciting to me. I can't go so far as to say that the noun faire, F-A-I-R-E in French, which means to do, came from that. But I just feel like it might, like to carry, to do something. Who knows? So with that, I'm going to go into my rabbit hole, and I will try to keep it brief from here on out because I've spent plenty of time on the etymology. But trivia, here we go. Uh-oh. So audience, please play along as I ask Allison this, but I'm asking all of you as well. True or false? Sometimes the human brain can recognize objects, but it can't recognize faces.
Sometimes.
Yes.
That is sometimes. True.
That is true. The condition is called prosopagnosia. It's from the Greek prosopon, I don't know if I'm saying that right, but prosopon being face and agnosia being ignorance. So a condition being ignorance of the face or of faces. So anyone who knows medical terminology, a lot of it is borrowed from Greek. So prosopagnosia, and that will be relevant as I continue down my rabbit hole, because I started to ask myself, first, how do humans achieve a differentiation on what we see in objects, right? If we know something is different than something else, I'm assuming we somehow visually are saying that this gets trippy. Something is different. It is separated from other things around it. That there is an inherent difference that then makes something a unit unto itself. To go really down, I mean, it's early to be thinking so broadly down a rabbit hole, but if we didn't think that way, there could be other alien species or something that see things entirely differently, because you're not looking in the light spectrum that we're looking at things. You're not looking, right? You're detecting different, you're detecting potentially particles that are larger than what we visually see. Just to go down that a little bit, right? We could be thinking things that we think of as being separate. I'm looking at my computer monitor and the desk. Perhaps that is perceived by other creatures in the galaxy as, or the universe as the same. Anyway, so get a little too heady today. So a lot of scientific studies have presented evidence that there was a part of the brain dedicated to doing this task, to recognizing objects. It was hinted at, it was seen as something that kind of had to be, but it was not until research in primates read out in 2019 that the existence of this region of the brain was kind of considered proven. Published in March of 2019 in an edition of Neuron, a publication, researchers, I might butcher this name, Rishi Rajalingam, and James J. DiCarlo, of the McGovern Institute for Brain Research at MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, reported their results from the chemical inhibition of parts of the temporal cortex in primates. Now, that might set some folks off in terms of treatment of primates in research, and I understand that, and that would be a discussion perhaps for another day, but you will see, I think I will make the case for how this may make huge advancements for the human condition for certain people. We'll get there. So when these areas of the brain were turned off chemically, the monkeys lost the ability to complete certain tasks that relied on object recognition. So you can imagine how exciting that is for science to say, oh, this area of the brain that we have assumed existed does in fact seem to exist, because we can show by turning it off that something happens. So what has been named, therefore, it's the inferior temporal cortex was proven to exist. So the inferior temporal cortex, or often referred to as the IT, is located in the temporal lobes of the brain. And these lobes are found on the sides of the brain running along the side of our head from about our ears to our temples. So basically just kind of like doors on a car, if you will, if you're looking at your brain, they're on the sides. The temporal lobe is involved in understanding and remembering what we see, our vision, understanding speech and language, and understanding emotions as well. So the IT plays a crucial role in, as I've described, this object recognition, or the ability to recognize and categorize things, including faces and other familiar objects. So it receives input from our primary visual cortex, and it processes increasingly complex features of visual stimuli, such as objects, textures, colors, etc. So because of this, it's considered organized hierarchically, with certain neurons responding to different levels of complexity. Again, that just blows the mind, in terms of like what the mind does and how it's organized to do certain things. So damage to the IT can result in impaired object recognition, as seen in the neurological conditions such as prosopagnosia. Quiz, what is that? We just talked about it in the question, the trivia question. That is difficulty in recognizing faces. Neuroimaging studies in humans have shown that the IT neurons respond selectively to specific object features, as we talked about, faces, buildings, whatever. So that hierarchical structure, as we talked about. It's thought that these neurons may also have an important role in memory and our ability to recognize objects across different viewpoints, right? And different lighting. We don't see the same object the same way every time. So that's what they mean in terms of memory, is it must be relying on some memory. And we've talked about that actually in rehearsal a little bit, interestingly enough, in how other parts of the brain might be needed to sort of fill in the gaps, right? You see something in the dark, you'd be like, we no longer are thinking about it because we're adults, most of us listening to this. But if you're a baby, you know, the brain has to say, well, it looks different, but I'm pretty sure that's a cup of water sitting on, you know, the shelf, just like doesn't look the same. So understanding the role of the IT in object recognition, right? This part of the brain has serious implications for understanding how the brain processes visual information overall and developing treatments for disorders that are impaired object recognition, such as the face blindness, but also you can go into a lot of other impairments that would be related to this, right? So understanding this, even just blindness itself and how we might therefore provide information to those that are blind in other ways becomes important, which is a really great segue into my second section, I think. But first, I want to pause for our second trivia question. Okay, trivia two. The global market for object recognition by artificial intelligence is forecast to reach what value by 2025? Is it A, $700 million, B, $900 million, C, $2.6 billion, or D, $6.4
billion? $6.4 billion.
Yes, you're absolutely right.
It has to be. It's like becoming more and more something
huge.
That...
Yeah. Absolutely.
It's built into everything we have.
Yep. Yeah, 6.4 billion, a report by Markets and Markets, the global market for AI object recognition, is going to grow from what was 1.4 billion in 2020 to 6.4 billion by 2025. A compound annual growth rate of 35.7%.
Wow.
Anyone in business or anyone, that is, everybody wants that kind of growth. So object recognition is a key task in AI. And what it involves is, right, as you may have already pieced together, certainly is identifying and classifying objects in images or in videos. So not only existing video, but in images that are being taken in sort of live stream, if you will. In recent years, deep learning approaches, specifically what's called convolutional neural networks. We'll talk about what that is, CNNs. Another CNN, have revolutionized object recognition in artificial intelligence. So a convolutional neural network, again, I may sound like I know what I'm talking about, but this was all me really diving into it this week in research and loving the learning process, is designed, it's designed for processing and analyzing data. So it's a neural network and it has sort of a grid-like structure so that it images and videos can be sort of broken down into component pieces, if you think of it that way, right? It's like overlaying a grid on what visually is being seen so that you can kind of slice it and dice it and understand what's happening in different patterns, right? So the main purpose of a CNN is to recognize and extract meaningful features from the data in a process called convolution. And I would assume I didn't really look into it, but you call it that because it's just constantly spiraling and going back over and finding patterns and things, right? So picture, I don't know, in layman's terms, a vase, and understanding what a vase is. Well, there's a lot of different forms to a vase, but there'll be things that will be in common. So if you lay a grid over it, you can then have data and a computer start to understand it on a much smaller level, what is in common in all of these images. So CNNs are trained on massive data sets, right, of labeled images, allowing them to learn these features and patterns and identify them. So based on object recognition systems have achieved state-of-the-art performance on several benchmark data sets. One in particular is called ImageNet. Talk a little bit about that, but basically just a database of just a massive amount of information on images. Transfer learning has also been used to improve object recognition in AI by adapting pre-trained CNNs to new tasks, right? So one thing to know about any coding really, but also artificial intelligence, is once you have something created as a unit, you can then redeploy it and build on that knowledge, right? So it's a massive momentum that takes giant leaps. Just to take a step back, if it's not already obvious in talking about the visual parts of the brain and trying to attack it and solve for human conditions. But just object recognition overall has a lot of practical applications. Some you already may be familiar with that have been making a splash in the last 5 to 10 years, self-driving cars and making those improved and safer. Image and video searches, like anybody who may already use the Google app on their phone, you can now do right searches by image. Those types of things are all made possible by this. And certainly polished use of augmented reality, where if you're looking through your phone at something, if you're not familiar with what augmented reality is, right, you're looking at a visual image through, say, your iPhone, and it is putting something overlaid on top of it. It's used a lot in training. It's used a lot in navigation, et cetera, et cetera. So the AI or the network needs to understand, say you're standing on the street and it's pointing out where a certain restaurant is. It needs to understand where the street is versus the buildings, et cetera, et cetera. A lot going on there. So one challenge in object recognition for artificial intelligence is developing systems that are robust enough to change in lighting, in viewpoint, when there are things are occluded or hidden. So what I was just talking about in our computer in our mind, in our heads, so to speak, our biological computers, we mentioned that memory is probably inherently called upon to fill in the gaps. So therefore, as you can imagine, with artificial intelligence, that is also a challenge. How do you train them on things and every permutation of lighting condition in rain and shine and, you know, et cetera, where half of it's hidden and we immediately can fill in the difference. But computers often cannot, but they're getting better. Should we start to wind down here? Another challenge is developing object recognition, able to recognize differences in like fine grained categories. So if you're looking at like a different species of birds or types of cars, right, as this whole thing is evolving, you're seeing the difference broadly from a bird to a dog. But as we want to get better, especially in training AI, you need to understand all the different types of birds. So you're going to get smaller and smaller and more granular. So object recognition can help the blind, as I mentioned, in several ways. One of the most significant applications would be in the development of wearable devices equipped with cameras that can detect and recognize objects in the wearer's environment. So just to bring the two parts of my kind of conversation together, right? How we as humans do this versus AI, it's kind of comes full circle in the drive to connect the two somehow. And I'm not saying that's about to happen tomorrow, but you know, we're making significant advances in that area. So to detect and recognize objects in the wearer's environment would be huge. And they would use these vision algorithms to identify, describe the objects to the user. And that can be in a few ways. I think the first steps would be in a speech interface. It may do the work for them and then speak to them or give them some sort of tactile feedback, a pulse, something like your phone buzzes, et cetera. That might be the beginning, but we'll see where it goes from there. Trivia three before I wrap up. How many images are broken into how many categories in ImageNet, the database? So we just talked about that. So I'll ask that again, right? This massive database. How many images are broken into how many categories? Is it A, 10,000 images across 200 categories? B, 50,000 images across 500 categories. C, 2 million images across 1,000 categories. Or D, 14 million images across 20,000 categories.
C.
2 million. And I know you're in the SAT approach of like, is it the extremes or not? It is the extreme in this case. It's D, 14 million images across.
I really thought that was maybe too extreme since it isn't as established yet.
Right.
So like, that's what I was thinking. Maybe it's less and it'll get there, but wow, that's incredible.
Right. No, that's great. Thank you, Allison. But yeah, it's 14 million images across.
That's great. Thank you, Allison. But
no, don't get it that way. No, I did appreciate your breaking it down because yeah, it feels like if it's new, how do they amass that much stuff already? But yeah, 14 million across 20,000. So ImageNet was created in 2009 by researchers at Princeton University as a part of an organized annual competition to further image awareness, consolidation in this database to set the groundwork, right, for this type of work. So the ImageNet database and that competition have become really important benchmarks in the field of computer vision research, right, is taken on. And clearly, if they've amassed that large database and have been really instrumental in the development of deep learning techniques. So not just anyone familiar with AI, it's also called data mining. It's also called deep learning. So the process by which they're doing this is being evolved and furthered by such a thing, but then also the outcome that they're particularly focused on, right? It is benefited. So particularly convolutional neural networks, just to round it out, those CNNs, which are being used for object recognition. So where I left off in my rabbit hole, where I would continue is, you know, there's ongoing research exploring the connection, as I hinted at and kind of, well, more than hinted at, sort of outwardly said, between AI object recognition and the inferior temporal part of the brain, right? So we found and proven this area. And when that area is damaged or somehow defunct in some way, can we then look to AI to really, I mean, we're talking cyborg shit right now, right? I mean, like the goal would be, as I mentioned, maybe it starts with some sort of text or spoken input, but can it go one better, and can it be actually connected to the brain itself, to put in, you know, that. So, but however, it should be noted that while there is promising research in the area, connecting AI object recognition directly to the brain is still, as you can imagine, wildly complex and a challenging problem. So there's still much more to learn about how the brain processes information. That's my deal this week.
That's amazing. My brain kind of hurts. after that, I'm just thinking about, a lot of topics bring us back to AI, right? Because that's kind of where we are right now in human and technology evolution. Yeah, and I'm just thinking about how far it's advanced since they were trying to teach it. Can't remember where I read this some time ago, but you know, one of the first things they tried to teach, like image stuff, was, is it a dog or is it not a dog? Literally starting with just these like yes or no questions,
right,
to build its intelligence. And then to start to get it more fine. So they show it another furry, you know, mammal and see if it can distinguish them. But I'm also thinking about Black Mirror again, since you were talking about the implantation. Doing implants into the brain.
Got it.
Yeah. And how truly amazing that
the
would
implementation
be,
right? Of implant
of implantation. How amazing that would be for people who, right, whose vision could then be augmented. That is absolutely mind blowing. So that was great. You really led me to believe that like this was going to be all etymology, and it was not. Although that part was fascinating, the whole thing was fantastic.
Yeah, hopefully, Allison and audience, it's not too disconnected. I thought the background was just the pure word geekiness was particularly cool this week, but yeah, not totally connected to where I went, but excellent. Well, should we transition into our big questions and then
we should wrap. I only have one, I actually have two, but one is quite literally, you don't have to answer. It's just for our audience and for both you and I to think about, but not talk about. Just kind of big question for the audience is, you know, thinking about what we can all do in our everyday lives to combat racism. In my experience, this world gets scarier by the day with climate change, hate speech, racism, war. So I'd love it if we could all spend some time thinking about how we promote unity and battle hate, even if it's really in small ways on a daily basis. If it means having a conversation that's difficult with someone or stepping in when we see microaggressions happening or whatever that is. I think there are so many ways. But my actual big question for you, Mark, is, and you really hit on this when you kind of brought up eugenics and how science can be misused. So it was perfect. As usual, I feel like you kind of always like get at where I'm going with the big questions. But you and I on this podcast, we tout all the time the importance of science. Mm-hmm. And in believing what science tells us, right? So if we don't know how we should feel or think about something or understand how something works, we should look to science, because the scientific method is an ingrained method that's relatively objective. I've talked about this before. But we've seen time and again, science being misused, science being overturned. So for instance, race scientists using it to find this, it becoming the thing. So how do we know what to believe when it comes to science? How do we know that someone says, this has been scientifically proven, so you should believe it, because we keep telling you believe in science is better than believing in, you know, anecdotal evidence, but then we see it overturned as well. So I'm just interested in your thoughts on that.
As always, you impress with really good questions. Such good questions that I do immediately jump, like, even the word I just used is jump, because I think I'm already hesitant. Like I have a thought. But I want to preface it with, right, it's a gut reaction, audience and Allison. And these are such big questions that, no simple answers. But where my mind went is what we're talking about really is the pursuit of truth. And truth, was it Nietzsche? I believe I'm rocking some Nietzsche, I think, is that truth is only a socially defined piece where you have, I'm thinking of data sets, we're thinking of AI, where for us to say something happened, You have to acknowledge it yourself, but you need it conferred with others. And it's only in the strength of how much data is repeating the same outcome that you are believing that that is true. However, there are so many layers on what we can see and what we can understand. It sounds like I'm backpedaling and being all over the place, but I'm not trying to be wishy-washy. I'm trying to like break this into something. That's one thing to keep in mind. It has to be duplicated. It has to be cross-checked. I think it's the first impulse when all of us see something that we don't quite believe is we ask somebody else, did you see that? Right. Oh my God, I can't believe that. You're seeing this? Right. For us to believe it, we already intrinsically need someone else to verify it. It's like peer-reviewed. If anybody knows the peer-reviewed term, right? Anything, any research paper, it's not peer-reviewed is already lesser in scientific realms because it has not been duplicated. It has not been pulled apart, challenged in a healthy, competitive way, a rigorous way, I should say. So the other thing, Allison, that your question brings to mind is for us to always remember that everything in science is us. It's like this image I have in my head. It's like we're seeing our existence and the truth around us as a sculpture that's half in shadow, if that makes sense. And we have described what we can see in the light. And we're checking with other people and we're all seeing that. But as more light grows, as we find other ways to cast more light on it, we need to remember that what is that sculpture? It may change dramatically at times. So what to believe is what we can all confer on, but also don't lock it in. What we believe is also has to be fluid because it should and will have to change. Does that make sense? And the last thing I'll say, I know I'm like going on and on, is that over all of that comes the ethics. That just because what we are looking, I'm going to stick with this weird in shadow sculpture thing that I just said, the way that we're looking at that, we're looking at something objective. Once you feel like what you're looking there is defined, if it's changing how you're treating the person looking at it next to you, in a way that feels against the golden rule, so to speak, right? Like that it is lowering their humanity versus yours. It's putting your experience heightened versus that. It's divisive. That's wrong. That just should immediately trip up and say that is wrong, right? Which I wish the eugenicists of the world would have realized in their pursuit of focusing on being so excited by viewing this sculpture in a certain way that process blinded them to how horrifying they were being to the people viewing that same sculpture next to them. Did I totally lose you? Is that just weird?
No, you didn't. To your point, these questions aren't meant like it's hard to give very concise answers to them because it's like, oh man, I have to think about that because I kind of know how I want to respond, but I haven't thought it through.
And
but
I hope you thank you for indulging me, you, Allison, and the audience as I went down that because that excites me. I feel like that's a really important question. It's one of the biggest questions I think we've asked on the show. So thank you, Allison.
And I think we've touched on before, maybe it was in the very first episode on Orbit, like, the scientific method is called an objective method. And like Mark said, you know, something isn't accepted in the scientific community until it's been peer reviewed and repeated. A result has to be repeatable to be considered, you know, okay, this is it. But I think what I had said in that episode is, and what Mark, you just said, we're constantly learning new things that might make us go, oh, well, we said this was impossible, da, 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 but it's not impossible because now we've just learned that ghosts do exist. I'm kidding. Or am I? I don't know. Right. But the point being, right, we're changing all the time what we understand, what we can see of the universe that we can't see right now with the senses that we have. And so I think you're right, Mark. I think we need to always be healthily questioning, like healthily cynical. We always have to look for like multiple sources of one thing. And we also have to keep an open mind and think about the justness of the science. And while you were talking, because I didn't know the Nietzsche thing about truth, I looked it up just very quickly.
Was I right? Is that him?
I think so, but I didn't want to keep clicking down. So just the quick answer to the question, what does Nietzsche say about truth? What one website says, he argued that truth is impossible. There can only be perspective and interpretation driven by a person's interests or will to power. So it sounds exactly kind of like what you were saying, right? It's all subjective. There is only the truth based
on how many other people are seeing the same thing. But And I, you know, shout out to and deep love for my amazing science teachers growing up, because I believe one of the first concepts I remember learning about science is that we call things laws, but only because they have been reinforced countless times so far that we call them laws. But can they be overturned? Yes. There is, quote unquote, a Supreme Court, if you will, in a conceptual way, of something can be challenged if new evidence comes to light that overturns something we've considered a law of physics for a long time. And those things have actually happened. We've talked about them on the show in several ways, several times.
Great.
Awesome.
All right. What do you got for me?
Okay. Mine is in a similar way. It's also sort of, it's big, but it's also just sort of a provocative question, maybe. I don't know. So I'll just say this. Has our mastery, it's a little out there, but go with me on this. Has our mastery of physical objects over our human history been an ever-evolving road from blunt, sort of rudimentary manipulation of large non-biologic materials into ever more complex systems of applications? First of all, now that I'm reading this, a lot of people are going to be like, well, no shit, Mark. It's like we used a rock as a tool and then it became an axe. And now it's, you know, yes. So, but go with me on this. Ever more complex systems, from really rudimentary manipulation of non-biological things into things like then the transistor, into computers. Now, and using those computers for self-learning computer software, AIs, right? Is this all going towards biologic computation and a mastery, quite literally, over life and death and all matter? What is used in religious areas as, quote unquote, right? If you were to think of like God figures having all power over life, death, manipulation of space, throwing aside all the religious garbage that comes with that, is that kind of what we're moving towards? When I mentioned before, right, that yes, it's an amazing step if we could build an AI, some piece of technology that goes in the brain and changes the IT part of the brain we talked about, inferior temporal. But imagine if we are no longer doing that with transistors and what we consider hard tech, like a computer, but we're actually finding biological ways to compute and do that. I mentioned last week that we have induced cells to keep a biological record of their own past history and cellular events. So that feels like it's laying the groundwork for biological nanocomputers. I know that's already happening, and we should maybe hopefully at some point we'll get a noun related to that and I can go down that rabbit hole. But like, are we moving towards that level of manipulation that becomes, we can do anything we want? However, with that, if this, does that raise the stakes and do the stakes raise and the risk of our own annihilation raise with each advancement? And therefore, isn't it just a game of chicken with our own nature? How long will we grow and be able to learn before we fail in a way that is catastrophic?
Yeah, so you literally just answered. So I was going to say, I think that is where we're going, but I don't know if we'll get there. You kind of just answered it for me, because each time we make an advance. So for instance, I was also going to say, when you're only halfway done with the question, like, okay, the tools. So first of all, you had piles and piles of stuff. And you took those piles of stuff. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah. I just had to work in piles. But then you were like, okay, you have a rock and it becomes an axe, right? And then you have an axe and you learn to chop things down. And then you chop those things down. You learn how to put them together. And then you learn about fire and you know, but like blah, blah, blah. And you get eventually to transistors. And then biologically, do we become the tools like in the Matrix, when then like AI and the things we've built have now become so much more advanced that they've taken over and they're using us as the actual tools, which kind of would be an interesting, you know, all the way around, full circle. There we go. That's what I was looking for.
To get a little Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Anybody knows that the mice were these super crazy. Yeah. Earth is a computer, blah, blah, blah. Anyway.
So no, but I think we are going there. We already have drugs that are called biologics, which are like, which are in no way, like, I'm not talking like nanobots that are in there doing things, right? That, but we already are figuring out more and more ways to do things that are tied to our biology. So I think it's, I think it would be inevitable in like a clean system. What I mean by that is if we could control for non-catastrophe, but I think we're more likely to blow ourselves up first, unfortunately. By the way, I had a good friend ask me this week who listens to this podcast. He said, I have to ask, do you consider yourself a fatalist? I said, why are you asking me that? He said, well, just listening to the podcast. He said, good, I don't think question. I would have defined you that way. But now, like listening, I kind of do. And I said, that's a really good question. I said, you know, I think when I was younger, I would have considered myself very much an optimist. I could find the good side of anything, the rosiest side, everything's gonna be okay. And then by the time I hit my mid-30s, I probably would have defined myself more as like a realistic optimist or an optimistic realist, right? Like, yes, I'm still going to like have a positive spin on things, but I understand the game, right? But I do think there are positive ways. But then I do realize in this podcast, I say a lot of things like, well, we'll never make it there, you know, or right. The world's ending. I am more despondent than I've ever been about the state of the world, but I'm not sure I'm quite the fatalist, but I thought it was an interesting view.
I love that you brought that up. It makes me think of this thought. If, and I'm usually right there with you, and I think in general I am, I'm like, the data and the probability that we will avoid a knee-jerk reaction into something that has devastating consequences. But here's an optimist. I'm forcing myself to be optimistic. Think of us moving through time as we're accumulating this power, so to speak, that it is ability to change more and more of our environment. But also we're learning from that. As long as we're always moment to moment being checked and balanced by our past growth in perspective and understanding, that therefore we now know what is at risk, is that not a positive influence keeping us going off the rails? Hopefully. I'm not saying it's not a knife edge. I'm not saying it doesn't fluctuate. It is such a knife edge that I feel like it actually might, person to person, give us a really important role to play in the most minute decisions we make in our own lives. That if it is that much of a knife edge, that we really are contributing to, you know what I mean? Does that make sense? If it's that minute, things can go completely off the rails for humanity or not, then even one person making the right choice at a certain time can
influence. Yeah. No, I agree with you, which I'm not going to say it because I think we've run really long, but the example of we almost had like nuclear warheads launched back during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And it was one Russian like general, not sure if he was a general, but very high up, who said,
it's not,
something just isn't quite right. I know we're seeing missiles coming at us. And if he hadn't done that, there would have been missiles launched. Yeah. So to your point, it was one man disobeying orders and going, I just don't think this is, you know, actually happening. So it is that.
And terrifyingly, this moment we could be having things occurring that we just don't know in the current conflicts. But
okay. We better get our new. Up. Yeah, we better wrap. I guess we better review our ratings and then.
Yes. So Allison, I'll call it out for you. Oh, you were a 7 on difference, coming in fairly mid optimistic on this word. How do you feel?
I am going to a full blown 10. I loved it. I love that. I knew immediately when we got the word, the direction I wanted to go, but I did also just poke around and there are so many options. To your point, the way you broke down the etymology, there are so many things to do on this and it's fascinating to think of it on different levels. And I loved it. It's my favorite one in a while.
Excellent. Oh, that's your very first 10. Amazing.
No, I think I moved Orbit up to 10 back in our very first episode.
Oh, you did. Sorry. Yeah. See, I got to scroll up in our records. All right. Well, you're second 10. So there you go. I am going to, God, I gave construction a 10.
Okay. Don't get distracted.
No, I know. I'm like,
That
is surprising. I'm going to give this a 9. I went up from an 8 to a 9. I really enjoyed this.
All right. We like this one collectively. Yeah. All right, Mark, give us our new noun.
Yes, absolutely. and
celebrating our difference.
Oh, yeah. Payment. I knew you were going to like it. I knew it. I'm on the fence.
Anything going into the like the capitalist world, I tend not to like. Like I didn't like shopping as well, hilariously. Payment. Okay.
Capitalism.
I know, but I'm just saying how my brain right works.
It Tune in next week, everybody, when we hash this out.
As we
yeah,
all right, I'm gonna so give it I'm straight down the middle five.
Five.
Oh, we're both trying to put it in. Hilarious.
Sure did. I'm going to go with six.
Okay, so we are one apart. Everyone, thank you for bearing with us. And with that, Mark, do you want to read us out?
Yes, absolutely. This has been another episode, everyone, of Renowned Podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in and listening to us. We hope you got something out of this, certainly. If you did, if you didn't, we would love you to reach out to us and let us know. You can find us on social media at Renowned Podcast, or you can visit us on the web at renownedpodcast.com. And of course, we always must ask, if you do enjoy the show, please consider following us or subscribing to the show on whatever platform you are watching on Spotify or YouTube, or listening to us on every other major podcast platform. You can usually do that by hitting follow or whatever the platform's specific way to do that is. We would also love it if you rated us. Having solid ratings lets others know about the quality of the show and helps us reach more people. And that's it. Please tune in next time for a new episode and a brand new noun payment. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye.